A form of clairvoyance was growing fast upon me, not the piercing psychic perceptions of Taverner, who saw straight into the inner soul of men and things, but a power to perceive the subtler aspects of matter. I could distinctly see the magnetic field which surrounds every living thing, and could watch the changes in its state. Presently I began to be aware of the coming and going of those unseen presences which were the gods that Diana worshipped. A strong wind, hot sun, or the bare uncultivated earth, seemed to bring them very near me, and I felt the great life of the trees. These things fed my soul and strengthened me as the touch of earth always strengthens any child of the earth mother. The days were lengthening towards the longest day. It would soon be 3 months since Diana returned to her own place, and I began to wonder how much longer Taverner would keep her now entirely cured patient, but he gave no sign. I began to feel, however, that Diana was now no longer a patient, but that I had become one, and that I was being closely watched in anticipation of a crisis that was imminent. Some abscess of the soul had to come to a head before it could be lanced, and Taverner was awaiting the process. The idea was slowly growing in my mind that I might marry Diana. Marriage did not express the relationship I wished to establish, but I could see no other course open to me. I did not wish to possess her, I only wanted our present relationship to continue, and that I should be free to come and go with her without running the gauntlet of censorious eyes. Taverner, I felt, knew this and fought it, and I could not see why. I could understand his objection to my compromising Diana, but I did not see why he should oppose my marriage to her. My brain, however, was in abeyance in these days. My thoughts were a series of pictures fading into each other like a phantasmagoria, and they told me afterwards that my speech had reverted to the simplicities of early childhood. But still Taverner waited, biding his time. The crisis came suddenly. As the sun was setting upon the evening of the longest day, Diana appeared upon the steps of the office window and beckoned me out. She appeared extraordinarily beautiful, with the burning sky behind her. The bright fluffed hair caught the level light and shone like an aureole as she stood with her strangely eloquent hands beckoning me out into the gathering dusk. I knew that there was in prospect such a race across the heather as had never yet been, and at the end of it I should meet the powers she worshipped face to face, and that from that meeting my body might return to the house, but my soul would never enter the habitations of men again. It would remain out there in the open, with Diana and her people. I knew all this, and with the inner vision could see the gathering of the clans that was even now taking place. Diana's hands called to me, and as if drawn by a spell, I rose slowly from my desk. Diana, thing of air, was calling me out to run with her. But I was not a thing of air, I was a man of flesh and blood, and in a flash of revelation I saw Diana as a beautiful woman and I knew that she was not the woman for me. To part of my nature she called, but she did not call to the whole of me, and I knew that the best in me would remain unmated and uncompanioned if I were to join Diana. It did Diana no harm to return to nature, because she was not capable of greater things. But there was more in me than the instincts, and I might not so return without loss to my higher self. The room was lined with books, the door leading into the laboratory stood open and the characteristic smell of the blended drugs came to me. Smells are surer than sights or sounds to make your heartstrings crack. Had the wind been the other way, had the smell of the pines blown in at the open window, I think I should have gone with Diana, but it was the odor of the laboratory that came to me, and with it the memory of all that I had hoped to make of my life, and I dropped back into my chair and buried my face in my arms. When I raised my head again the last light of the sunset had gone, and so had Diana. That night my sleep was heavy and dreamless, which was a great relief, for of late it had been troubled by strange, almost physical impressions, the fantasies of the day becoming the realities of the darkness, but with my rejection of Diana a spell seemed to break, and when I awoke in the morning it was to a normality to which I had been a stranger for many a day. My grip on the organization of the home had come back to me, and I felt as one who had been in exile in a foreign country and has at length returned to his native land. Diana I did not see for several days, for she had again taken to the heather, and rumors of raids upon gardens and fowl houses by a particularly ingenious and elusive gypsy explained why she did not even return to be fed. My conscience pricking me for my recent lapse, I took upon myself the somewhat arduous task of taking Tennant out for walks, for since his attempt at suicide we had not dared to let him go about alone. It was a dreary business, for Tennant never spoke unless he was addressed, and then only employed the unavoidable minimum of speech. He had certainly made no progress during the months he had been at the nursing home, and I was surprised that Taverner had kept him so long, for he usually declined to keep any case which he considered hopeless. I therefore concluded that he had hopes for Tennant, though in what direction they lay he did not confide to me. We swung over the heather paths in the direction of Frensham, and I suddenly realized to my annoyance that we were following Diana's favorite trail to the little fir wood of magic and ill omen. I would willingly have avoided it if I could, for I did not wish to be reminded of certain incidents which I felt it was better for my peace of mind that I should forget, but there was no alternative unless we waded for a mile or two through knee-deep heather. In the light shadow of the trees we paused, Tennant gazing up the long shafts of the trunks into the dark tufted crests that looked like islands in the sky. Wendy's house in the treetops. I heard him say to himself, oblivious of my presence, and I guessed that his weary soul would love to sleep forever in the rocking cradle of the branches. The sun drew all the incense from the firs, and the sky had that intense Italian blue that is often seen over these great wastes. A warm wind blew softly over the heather, bringing the sound of innumerable bees and faraway sheep. We flung ourselves down on the sun-warmed earth, and even Tennant, for once, seemed happy. As for me, every breath I drew of that warm radiant air brought peace and healing to my spirit. Tennant propped against a tree, hat off, shirt open, and head thrown back against the rough red bark, sat gazing into the blue distance and whistling softly between his teeth. I lay flat on my back among the pine needles, and I think I went to sleep. At any rate, I never heard the approach of Diana, nor was aware of her presence until I raised my head. She lay at Tennant's feet gazing into his face with the unblinking steadiness of an animal, and he was whistling as softly as before, but with an exquisite, flute-like tone, those strange cadences of his that had been the origin of all my trouble. I thought of the older Greek world of centaurs and titans, who ranged and ruled before Zeus and whose court made heaven human. Tennant was not even primitive, he was pre-Adamic. As for Diana, she was no daughter of Eve, but of the dark Lilith who preceded her, and I realized that those two were of the same world and belonged to each other. A twinge of the old wound shot through me at this realization, and also a twinge of envy, for theirs was a happier lot than our civilized bondage, but I lay quiet, watching their riddle. The shadows of the firs lay far out over the heather before I roused Tennant for our return to earth, and as we came back through the golden evening light, Diana came with us. When I told Taverner of this incident, over our usual after-dinner smoking, half report, half gossip, I saw that it was no surprise to him. "I hoped that would happen," he said. "It is the only possible solution to the case that I can think of, but what will her family say?" "I think they will say, praise the Lord, and economize over her trousseau," I replied, and my prophecy proved correct. It was the queerest wedding I ever saw. The parson, thoroughly uncomfortable, but afraid to refuse to perform the ceremony. The upholstered mother and her friends trying hard to do the thing properly, the bridegroom's relatives, whose attempt to get him certified at the 11th hour had been balked by Taverner, furiously watching £10,000 of trust monies passing out of their keeping, a bride who looked like a newly caught wild thing, and who would have bolted out of the church if Taverner had not shown her very clearly that he was prepared for such a maneuver and would not permit it, and a bridegroom who was far away in some heaven of his own, and upon whose face was a glory that never shone on land or sea. The departure of the happy couple upon their honeymoon was a sight for the gods, whom I am convinced were present. All the wedding guests in their wedding garments were drawn up about the front door, When out came Diana in her Puck's tunic and bolted like a rabbit down the drive, at a more sober pace followed her spouse leading a donkey upon whose back was packed a tent and from whose flanks dangled cooking pots. Surrounded by the broadcloth of the men and the silks of the women, and against the background of the clipped laurels of the shrubbery they looked incongruous, daft, degenerate, everything their relatives said they were. But the minute they had passed the gate and set foot upon the black soil of the moor, there was a change. Great presences came to meet them, and whether they perceived them or not, a silence fell upon the wedding party. In 10 seconds the moor took them, man, girl, and donkey, fading into its grey browns in the most amazing fashion, as if they had simply ceased to exist. They had gone to their own place, and their own place had made them welcome. A civilization with which they had nothing to do would never again have the power to torture and imprison them for being different. In dead silence the wedding party went in to eat its wedding breakfast, and no one remembered to give any toasts. We heard no more of the wayfarers until the following spring, when there came a tap upon the office window after lights out, which instantly put me in mind of Diana. It was not she, however, but her husband. Taverner was absent, but in response to a brief request I accompanied my summoner. We had not far to go. The little brown tent was pitched almost under the lee of our wood, and I saw in an instant why I had been summoned, though there was little need to summon me, for the nature gods can look after their own. It is only we superior beings who have to be dragged into the world by the scruff of our necks. The gates of life swung upon easy hinges, and in a few minutes a little granddaughter of Pan lay in my hands. A little, new-made perfection, save for the tufted ears. I wondered what new breed of mortals had been introduced into our troubled old world to disturb its civilization. Oh, Taverner, I thought, what will the future hold you responsible for? Will it rank you with the man who introduced rabbits into Australia? Or with Prometheus? End of this story, and next is the subletting of the mansion. Build thou more stately mansions, O my soul. The post bag of the nursing home was always sent to the village when the gardeners departed at 6, so if any belated letter writer desired to communicate with the outer world at a later hour, he had to walk to the pillar box at the crossroads with his own missives. As I had little time for my private letter writing during the day, the dusk usually saw me with a cigar and a handful of letters taking my after-dinner stroll in that direction. It was not my custom to encourage the patients to accompany me on these strolls, for I felt that I did my duty towards them during working hours, and so was entitled to my leisure. But Winnington was not quite in the position of an ordinary patient, for he was a personal friend of Taverner's, and also, I gathered, a member of one of the lesser degrees of that great fraternity of whose work I had had some curious glimpses, and so the fascination which this fraternity always had for me, although I have never aspired to its membership, together with the amusing and bizarre personality of the man, made me meet halfway his attempt to turn our professional relationship into a personal one. Therefore it was that he fell into step with me down a long path that ran through the shrubbery to the little gate, at the far end of the nursing home garden, which gave upon the crossroads where the pillar box stood. Having posted our letters, we were lounging back across the road when the sound of a motor horn made us start aside, for a car swung round the corner almost on top of us. Within it I caught a glimpse of a man and woman, and on top was a considerable quantity of luggage. The car turned in at the gate of a large house whose front drive ran out at the crossroads, and I remarked to my companion that I supposed Mr. Hirschman, the owner of the house, had got over his interment and come back to live there again, for the house had stood empty, though furnished, since a trustful country had decided that its confidence might be abused, and that the wily Teuton would bear watching. Meeting Taverner on the terrace as we returned to the house, I told him that Hirschman was back again, but he shook his head. "That was not the Hirschmans you saw," he said, "but the people they have let the house to. Bellamy, I think their name is. They have taken the place furnished. Either one or other of them is an invalid, I believe." A week later I was again strolling down to the pillar box when Taverner joined me, and smoking vigorously to discourage the midges, we wandered down to the crossroads together. As we reached the pillar box, a faint creak attracted our attention, and looking round, we saw that the large iron gates barring the entrance to Hirschman's Drive had been pushed ajar and a woman was slipping softly through the narrow opening they afforded. She was obviously coming to the post, but seeing us, hesitated. We stood back, making way for her, and she slipped across the intervening gravel on tiptoe, posted her letter, half bowed to us in acknowledgement of our courtesy, and vanished silently as she had come. "There is a tragedy being worked out in that house," remarked Tavener. I was all interest, as I always am, at any manifestation of my chief's psychic powers, but he merely laughed. "Not clairvoyance this time, Rhodes, but merely common sense. If a woman's face is younger than her figure, then she is happily married. If the reverse, then she is working out a tragedy." "I did not see her face," I said, "but her figure was that of a young woman."
"I saw her face," said Tavener, "and it was that of an old one." His strictures upon her were not entirely justified, however, for a few nights later Winnington and I saw her go to the post again, and although her face was heavily lined and colourless, it was a very striking one, and the mass of auburn hair that surrounded it seemed all the richer for its pallor. I am afraid I stared at her somewhat hard, trying to see the signs from which Tavener had deduced her history. She slipped out through the scarcely opened gate, moving swiftly but stealthily, as one accustomed to need concealment, gave us a sidelong glance under long dark lashes, and retreated as she had come. It was the complete immobility of the man at my side which drew my attention to him. He stood rooted to the ground, staring up the shadow drive where she had disappeared as if he would send his very soul to illuminate the darkness. I touched his arm. He turned to speak, but caught his breath, and the words were lost in the bubbling cough that means hemorrhage. He threw one arm round my shoulders to support himself, for he was a taller man than I, and I held him while he coughed up the scarlet arterial blood which told its own story. I got him back to the house and put him to bed, for he was very shaky after his attack, and reported what had happened to Tavener. "I don't think he is going to last long," I said. My colleague looked surprised. "There is a lot of life in him," he said. "There is not much left of his lungs," I answered, "and you cannot run a car without an engine." Winnington was not laid up long, however, and the first day we let him out of bed he proposed to go to the post with me. I demurred, for it was some little distance there and back, but he took me by the arm and said, "Look here, Rhodes, I've got to go." I asked the reason for so much urgency. He hesitated, and then he burst out, "I want to see that woman again." "That's Mrs. Bellamy," I said. "You had better let her alone, she is not good for you. There are plenty of nice girls on the premises you can flirt with if you want to. Let the married women alone, the husbands only come round and kick up a row, and it is bad for the nursing home's reputation." But Winnington was not to be headed off. "I don't care whose wife she is, she's the woman I never thought I should see," he finished lamely. "Hang it all, man, I am not going to speak to her or make an ass of myself, I only want to have a look at her. Anyway, I don't count, I have pretty nearly finished with this sinful flesh, what's left of it." He swayed before me in the dusk, tall, gaunt as a skeleton, with a colour in his cheeks we should have rejoiced to see in any other patient's, but which was a danger signal in his. I knew he would go, whether I consented or not, so I judged it best we should go together, and thereafter it became an established thing that we should walk to the crossroads at post time whether there were letters or not. Sometimes we saw Mrs. Bellamy slip silently out to the post, and sometimes we did not. If we missed her for more than 2 days, Winnington was in a fever, and when for 5 consecutive days she did not appear, he excited himself into another hemorrhage and we put him to bed, too weak to protest. It was while telling Tavener of this latest development that the telephone bell rang. I, being nearest the instrument, picked it up and took the message. "Is that Dr. Tavener?" said a woman's voice. "This is Dr. Tavener's nursing home," I replied. It is Mrs. Bellamy of Headington House who is speaking. I should be grateful if Dr. Tavenner would come and see my husband. He has been taken suddenly ill. I turned to give the message to Tavenner, but he had left the room. A sudden impulse seized me. Dr. Tavenner is not here at the moment, I said, but I will come over if you like. I am his assistant. My name is Rhodes. Dr. Rhodes. I should be very grateful, replied the voice. Can you come soon? I am anxious. I picked up my cap and went down the path I had so often followed with Winnington. Poor chap, he would not stroll with me again for some time, if ever. At the crossroads I paused for a moment, marveling that the invisible barrier of convention was at last lowered and that I was free to go up the drive and speak with the woman I had so often watched in Winnington's company. I pushed the heavy gates ajar just as she had done, walked up the deeply shaded avenue, and rang the bell. I was shown into a sort of morning room where Mrs. Bellamy came to me almost immediately. I want to explain matters to you before you see my husband, she said. The housekeeper is helping me with him, and I do not want her to know. You see, the trouble I am afraid is drugs. So Tavenner had been right as usual, she was working out a tragedy. He has been in a stupor all day, and I am afraid he has taken an overdose. He has done so before, and I know the symptoms. I felt that I could not get through the night without sending for someone. She took me to see the patient and I examined him. His pulse was feeble, breathing difficult, and color bad, but a man who is as inured to the drug as he seemed to be is very hard to kill, more's the pity. I told her what measures to take, said I did not anticipate any danger, but she could phone me again if a change took place. As she wished me goodbye, she smiled, and said, I know you quite well by sight, Dr. Rhodes. I have often seen you at the pillar box. It is my usual evening walk, I replied. I always take the letters that have missed the post bag. I was in two minds about telling Winnington of my interview, wondering whether the excitement into which it would throw him or his continued suspense would be the lesser of the two evils, and finally decided in favor of the former. I went up to his room when I got back, and plunged into the matter without preamble. Winnington, I said, I have seen your divinity. He was all agog in a minute, and I told him of my interview, suppressing only the nature of the illness, which I was in honor bound not to reveal. This, however, was the point he particularly wished to know, although he knew that I naturally could not tell him. Finding me obdurate, he suddenly raised himself in bed, seized my hand, and laid it to his forehead. No, you don't. I cried, snatching it away, for I had by now seen enough of Tavenner's methods to know how thought reading was done, but I had not been quick enough, and Winnington sank back on the pillowless bed chuckling. Drugs, he said, and breathless from his effort, could say no more, but the triumph in his eyes told me that he had learnt something which he considered of vital importance. I went round next morning to see Bellamy again. He was conscious, regarded me with sulky suspicion, and would have none of me, and I saw that my acquaintance with his household was likely to end as it had begun, at the pillar box. An evening or two later Mrs. Bellamy and I met again at the crossroads. She answered my greeting with a smile, evidently well enough pleased to have someone to speak to beside her boorish husband, for they seemed to know no one in the district. She commented on my solitary state. What has become of the tall man who used to come with you to the post? She inquired. I told her of Poynington's condition. Then she said a curious thing for one who was a comparative stranger to me, and a complete stranger to Winnington. Is he likely to die? She asked, looking me straight in the face with a peculiar expression in her eyes. Surprised by her question, I blurted out the truth. I thought so, she said. I am Scotch, and we have second sight in our family, and last night I saw his wraith. You saw his wraith? I exclaimed mystified. She nodded her auburn head. Just as clearly as I see you, she replied. In fact, he was so distinct that I thought he must have been another doctor from the nursing home whom you had sent over in your stead to see how my husband was getting on. I was sitting beside the bed with the lamp turned low, when a movement caught my notice, and I looked up to see your friend standing between me and the light. I was about to speak to him when I noticed the extraordinary expression of his face, so extraordinary that I stared at him and could find no word to say, for he seemed to be absolutely gloating over me or my husband, I could not tell which. He was standing up straight, not his usual stoop. So you have been watching him too, I thought, and his face wore a look of absolute triumph, as if he had at last won something for which he had waited and worked for a very long time, and he said to me quite slowly and distinctly, "It will be my turn next." I was just about to answer him and ask what he meant by his extraordinary behavior, when I suddenly found that I could see the lamp through him, and before I had recovered from my surprise he had vanished. I took it to mean that my husband would live, but that he himself was dying. I told her that from my knowledge of the two cases her interpretation was likely to prove a true one, and we stood for some minutes telling ghosts' stories before she returned through the iron gates. Winnington was slowly pulling round from his attack, though as yet unable to leave his bed. His attitude concerning Mrs. Bellamy had undergone a curious change. He still asked me each day if I had seen her at the pillar box and what she had had to say for herself, but he showed no regret that he was not well enough to accompany me thither and make her acquaintance. Instead, his attitude seemed to convey that he and she were partners in some secret in which I had no share. Although he was over the worst, his last attack had so pulled him down that his disease had got the upper hand, and I saw that it was unlikely that he would ever get out of bed again, so I indulged his foible in regard to Mrs. Bellamy, feeling sure that no harm could come of it. Her visits to the pillar box, what she said, and what I said were duly reported for the benefit of the sick man, whose eyes twinkled with a secret amusement while I talked. As far as I could make out, for he did not give me his confidence, he was biding his time till Bellamy took another overdose, and I should have felt considerable anxiety as to what he intended to do then had I not known that he was physically incapable of crossing the room without assistance. Little harm could come, therefore, from letting him daydream, so I did not seek to fling cold water on his fantasies. One night I was aroused by a tap at my door and found the night nurse standing there. She asked me to come with her to Winnington's room, for she had found him unconscious, and his condition gave her anxiety. I went with her, and as she had said, he was in a state of coma, pulse imperceptible, breathing almost non-existent. For a moment I was puzzled at the turn his illness had taken, but as I stood looking down at him, I heard the faint click in the throat followed by the long sibilant sigh that I had so often heard when Taverner was leaving his body for one of those strange psychic expeditions of his, and I guessed that Winnington was at the same game, for I knew that he had belonged to Taverner's fraternity and had doubtless learned many of its arts. I sent the nurse away and settled myself to wait beside our patient as I had often waited beside Taverner, not a little anxious, for my colleague was away on his holiday, and I had the responsibility of the nursing home on my shoulders. Not that that would have troubled me in the ordinary way, but occult matters are beyond my ken, and I knew that Taverner always considered that these psychic expeditions were not altogether unaccompanied by risk. I had not a long vigil, however. After about 20 minutes I saw the trance condition pass into natural sleep, and having made sure that the heart had taken up its beat again and that all was well, I left my patient without rousing him and went back to bed. Next morning, as Winnington did not refer to the incident, I did not either, but his ill-concealed elation showed that something had transpired upon that midnight journey which had pleased him mightily. That evening when I went to the pillar box I found Mrs. Bellamy there waiting for me. She began without preamble, "Dr. Rhodes, did your tall friends die during the night?" "No," I said, looking at her sharply. "In fact he is much better this morning." "I am glad of that," she said, "for I saw his wraith again last night, and wondered if anything had happened to him." "What time did you see him?" I inquired, a sudden suspicion coming into my mind. "I don't know," she replied. "I did not look at the clock, but it was some time after midnight. I was wakened by something touching my cheek very softly, and thought the cat must have got into the room and jumped on the bed, I roused myself, intending to put it out of the room, when I saw something shadowy between me and the window. It moved to the foot of the bed, and I felt a slight weight on my feet, more than that of a cat, about what one would expect from a good-sized terrier, and then I distinctly saw your friend sitting on the foot of the bed, watching me. As I looked at him, he faded and disappeared, and I could not be sure that I had not imagined him out of the folds of the eiderdown, which was thrown back over the footboard, so I thought I would ask you whether there was anything to account for what I saw. Whinnington is not dead, I said.